You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, July 24th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, sadly, no time for crotch shots reports nor baby updates. Sorry about that, folks. However, we will have David Dayen on the potential of a Larry Summers appointment to run the Federal Reserve. Also on the program today, we will break down a very important speech given by Ron Wyden at the Center for American Progress as a preface to our interview with Glenn Greenwald tomorrow. Also today in the House, we're anticipating a vote on the Amish amendment to the Pentagon's budget, co-sponsored by John Conyers, to curtail their surveillance activities of the NSA, which is creating a lot of concern with the administration, but is getting the backing of more and more congresspeople from both sides of the aisle. Also talk about one of the major issues in the Detroit, well, at this point, non-bankruptcy. And good news, the sequester isn't hurting everyone. Bad news as to who it isn't hurting. And the heartwarming story of a police chief in Pennsylvania who, well, just horrible. Iowa Steve King coming out with another way of saying brown people are horrible. And we will also finally get to the story about the McDonald's wage guide, I guess. And living, what is it? Living guide. Who knows? We will get to all that and more on today's program. I don't want to spend too much time dwelling on this, but I am just stunned by the amount of coverage wall to wall between the prince and his wife Kate Middleton having a baby, and then also the wiener stuff, just on news programs that I anticipate will not be discussing that stuff. At least not. I mean, I understand you have to discuss it, but to allow it to completely dictate everything that you bring on a show, it's just really just stunning.
I'm actually shocked at how the Wiener story steamrolled over that royal baby.
All of it is just so. I know many people tune into this program because we don't cover those things. And if you appreciate that, please become a member and support what we're doing here. There's far more money, apparently, in the Wiener coverage or the royal baby coverage. I just don't know that I could handle it, frankly.
Who knew there was more money in Wiener?
Yes. On a good note, We have been covering for some time the Moral Mondays that's been taking place in North Carolina, a state that's been completely overrun by Republican legislator, Republican governor. Among other things, they have been working overtime to restrict the rights of people in North Carolina to vote. And we've seen over the past, now I think 2 months, maybe more, hundreds of people being arrested, thousands of people protesting every Monday at the North Carolina legislature. And it apparently is at least reaching the citizenry of North Carolina. Only 25% of voters, according to a new poll, support a proposal to forbid parents from claiming college students registered to vote away from home as dependents on their state taxes, compared to 57% who are opposed. In other words, they are attempting essentially to levy a tax penalty on students who would vote when they're at college as opposed to their homes, and to levy that penalty on to their parents. Upwards around $2,500 per family. Just 33% of voters also support cutting the early voting period by a week, while 59% are opposed. So the message is getting out in North Carolina. I don't know if the Republicans are going to pay a price at the ballot box next time up, but we shall see. At least the people in North Carolina are aware of what's going on in their state. And a lot of that credit has to go to the people who are going out and protesting every Monday. So that's some good news there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dayan. On the phone. No, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program independent journalist, but he writes for just about everyone. And you can always find out what he's written by going to his Tumblr. David Dayan, welcome to the program, David.
Thank you very much. That's daviddayan.tumblr.com.
Yes,
or davedayan.com if it's easier for you.
We will of course, link to it on the blog at majority.fm. Let me just see if I can get that one right.
All right.
David, so it now, yep. And it sort of appears out of, maybe not so much out of nowhere, but sort of Larry Summers seems to have shot to the top of the list of presumptive replacements for Ben Bernanke. Tell us who else is on that list.
It's really a two-man race at this point, or two-person race, I should say. Summers was kind of waging a one-man campaign led by Larry Summers to become chairman of the Fed. He certainly made it known publicly in the media that he wanted this position. And the kind of conventional wisdom was that Janet Yellen, who is currently the vice chair, would be elevated to the chair position. Yellen has worked pretty much hand in hand with Bernanke, particularly on things like quantitative easing. She supports the program of financial regulation that the Fed has been putting through. That includes stronger capital and leverage requirements on the largest banks. And it was just seen that for continuity's sake that Janet Yellen would become the pick. Over, I think, the last week, maybe 72 hours even, it's certainly been brought to my attention by a lot of worried people that Summers had vaulted to the lead here and was on the verge of being selected. As far as what I've heard, the people inside the White House who have worked with Summers, who are colleagues of Summers, have been pitching the president on choosing Summers and specifically not choosing Yellen in a very gender-coded way. And this has been out there. Ezra Klein wrote something about the sort of sexist whisper campaign against Yellen, but this has been confirmed to me that they're really talking about Yellen by saying that she's not strong enough to run the Fed, that she won't have the confidence of the financial markets, which is all really a kind of a coded way of saying don't pick this woman, even though she would be, you know, she would shatter a glass ceiling. She would be the first female Federal Reserve chair in history. And choose Larry Summers instead. And the fact that Larry Summers has some unfortunate remarks about women in his background just absolutely magnifies this, that he would you'd be passing over the first woman for a historic position, that there was this whisper campaign, and now you're going to pick Larry Summers to boot. So this is going to be a real problem, I think, with the president's base, which is largely, has been appealing to women over the last year. But that's kind of a sidelight for what right. this means sort of for the economy.
All right. Well, tell us what the two biggest, I guess, and you write preoccupations of the Fed at the moment. What are they?
Right. So I wrote in Salon that really there are two things that the Fed is going to be concerned with, and that is when to ease up or whether to ease up on these unconventional monetary measures that they've been doing, these quantitative easing programs, so mass purchases of, in this case, mortgage-backed securities. You could stretch that out and say, when are they going to raise the federal funds rate, interest rates, and what are they basically going to do on the economy? Because really right now, I mean, the president's giving a speech today on the economy at Knox College in Illinois, and none of it really matters because the House is controlled by Republicans. Fiscal policy is basically stuck, if not about to get actively worse with debt ceiling brinksmanship. And really the only position that matters for the economy over the next couple years and maybe longer is the Federal Reserve chair, because that's really the only position that's going to have the free hand to take steps that could actually improve our economic performance.
So our government is in a state right now where we have no real ability to provide the economy much needed fiscal stimulus in terms of spending. And so we need to right. rely on monetary policy, which has the ability to basically create money and stimulate the economy in that way.
Right. And from the people that I've talked to that are concerned about the Summers pick, he would be more willing to ease up on those brakes and more concerned with sort of the inflation targets, whether inflation gets out of control, than the full employment mandate of the Federal Reserve, vis-a-vis Yellen, who is certainly an inflation dove. She's someone who said a little inflation is a good thing, she would be right in line with the program that we're seeing now at the Fed. So on the economy, there's that point.
All right,
the
and I just want to I want to just make sure that people understand that the Fed has a dual mandate. That is to deal with to create employment essentially, and to control inflation. That's those are the basic
full employment and price stability. Yes, and they're failing both right now. I mean, inflation is below even a modest 2% target, and it's been decelerating for the last 2 years. The employment situation, unemployment is still very high relative to times of a normal economy. And so measures need to be taken by the Fed to remedy that. And they've done some things to a degree. But they have not taken the steps necessary. And when you look at what Yellen would do or what Summers would do, you know, the choices between, it's somewhat unattractive choice between maintain what's going on now or maybe go further, or, in the case of Summers, not maintain what is happening now and maybe pull back. That's more conjecture, but that is the position of the people I've been talking to. They're concerned about this pick.
And any rise in inflation is perceived by people who own essentially loans as problematic because it devalues the value of their loan.
Correct.
And correct. Of course, their money that they may have, which is a rather specific group of people in this country at this point.
And the assumption is that they would then, you know, rush their investments through and but inflation also could have a positive salutary effect on wages and generally, you know, keeping money tight is going to result in less investment in the economy, whereas keeping money loose, while it might raise inflation a bit, is going to encourage more investment in the economy. And that's kind of the simplest way you can put it, and that's what the Fed is trying to do. And you saw this, that when interest rates went up, when they decided, when Ben Bernanke said back in May that they might taper their purchases of their monetary stimulus actions, interest rates shot up and people pulled back. And that was particularly true on mortgages, but also the regular interest rate on Treasury bills. So you can see how, you know, that kind of talk could get the economy into a bit more trouble. And if it's the only engine that we have available to us, then you're going to want someone who isn't going to partake in that. And that's sort of the case for Yellen over Summers on that point.
And
now, I think it's bigger. The bigger deal is financial regulation, so we can get into that.
Yes, all right. That's the second point you made, is that the Fed has responsibility for executing a lot of the financial regulations in Dodd-Frank.
Yes, and so far, it's certainly been mixed. My understanding is that there are, you know, at the staff level of the Fed, you still have a lot of Greenspan guys in there who kind of are allergic to regulation. But under Daniel Tarullo, who's sort of the point person on financial regulation, there have been some modest victories, and they did tighten capital requirements, sort of the loss absorption for banks, the ability to for them to cover their own mistakes rather than throwing them upon the taxpayer. And so we've seen that over the last, you know, 6 months or so. Larry Summers, there's probably no one who has a worse track record on financial regulation than Larry Summers in America, Democrat or Republican. I mean, this is the guy that threw Brooks Lieborn out of the room when she wanted to regulate derivatives, which was a major driver of the financial crisis. This is the guy who was Treasury Secretary, not just when the Glass-Steagall Act was finally given a burial, but also the one who oversaw the passage of the Commodity Futures Trading, Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which banned any regulation of derivatives, including credit default swaps, which are just bets on bets, which magnified the crisis. This is the guy who in 2005 at a Federal Reserve conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, dismissed the very prescient words of an economist named Raghuram Rajan, who said that we're headed towards a financial crisis because of mortgage-backed securities. And Summers called him a Luddite and said he was misinformed, and there's no problem, and of course we saw just 2 years later what happened. So, you know, the track record for 15 years is absolutely horrible. And then during the Dodd-Frank debate, as I understand it, Summers was against the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or tried to undermine it at least. He was certainly against tighter regulation on mortgage companies in terms of instituting cram down, which would have allowed bankruptcy judges to modify the terms of mortgages. He promised Jeff Merkley, among others, that he would initiate a $75 billion program of mortgage relief, and he, you know, the administration really botched that. That was HAMP, and they didn't do it. There's a sense that Summers has failed upwards for the last 15 years, and miraculously, it's about to happen again.
Yeah, this is pretty stunning, and there doesn't. I mean, what moves the president on this? I mean, is there anything that how much outcry is needed to make a difference, or is it really just? I mean, you know, we're talking about a position that is fairly. I mean, the Fed is less opaque than it was, I guess, 5-6 years ago. But the process is pretty, is not exactly transparent. And this is a guy who will sit there for 8 years, 10 years, 12 years. I mean, this is an extended position.
Yeah, I mean, it's 4-year terms, but they're often, you know, added on no matter who is in the White House. You often see multiple terms for the Fed chair. As far as what's going to move the president on this, I think confirmability is probably one thing. You've already seen Senator Merkley, for example, put out a tweet that said, you know, very disconcerting to see Larry Summers as the potential choice here. It's not a done deal, but it's pretty close, and he's definitely in the lead. And, you know, what was expressed to me is that there's going to need to be a sustained campaign, as there was when during the transition, when Obama really did want to make Larry Summers the Treasury Secretary. And there was enough of an outcry that he ended up getting bounced inside the White House as the chair of the NEC, I believe, or the Council of Economic Advisors, one or the other. I think National Economic Council, actually. Anyway, as sort of an in-house economic chair that wouldn't have to be confirmed. But, you know, that the fact that Summers only didn't get Treasury because there were a lot of people who screamed about it. And so there may be a sense among liberals that the same kind of thing needs to happen again. And the difference is that there is no consolation prize for Summers here. It's he either gets a Fed chair or he goes back to Harvard.
Right, so, and loses more of their endowment, I guess.
loses more of the endowment, exactly.
And so the scenario which would, I mean, presumably the White House is going to try and avoid nominating someone that they are aware will not be confirmed. How would he not be confirmed? In other words, would it be a handful of liberal senators and then the Republicans who are happy to deny President Obama a nominee? What would that look like?
I think you're describing it. I mean, you know, if you get a handful of liberal senators and say there's no way we're choosing Larry Summers for this position, and then Mitch McConnell gets in his head that he can, engineer a loss for the president, which would be, you know, a nice thing for his reelection campaign, perhaps. then you can see a scenario where Summers would get, wouldn't even have a majority of the Senate. But you know, if that might not, that might not happen. I mean, there may be a serious contingent of Republicans who would be supportive of Summers, who has certainly favored deregulatory policies for the bulk of his life as an economist and politician, or at least a political figure. So it's a bit unclear. I mean, I think that there's a perception that if you make this just sort of too hot to handle right away and shoot down this trial balloon, then there's a chance that, that it never happens. And I think that the issue of Yellen and the issue of how this is being pitched is pretty crucial here. You know, there are 20 women in the U.S. Senate, and if they perceive how that this went down the way it's being described to me that it's going down, that could be significant.
So what organization or which senators should listeners, if they're so inclined, contact to weigh in on this? I mean, where's the best place?
Well, certainly their own, but, you know, I mean, members of the banking committee obviously would be people that you would want to talk to. Perhaps the only positive that would come out of this is to see Summers grilled by Elizabeth Warren at a Senate Banking Committee confirmation hearing. So maybe she would be a good source or someone to go to express concern about this. But you know how it is. Typically, senators listen to people from their home states. So certainly talk to your home state senators. You think that the guy who has the most miserable track record in America on financial regulation and the financial crisis maybe shouldn't be in charge of a major financial regulatory position.
That, to me, is what we call around here a slam dunk. David Dayen, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
All right, man. Thanks.
All right, folks. Now, what we're going to do now is tomorrow, we recorded an interview yesterday with Glenn Greenwald. We're going to play that interview tomorrow. In the meantime, there is going to be a vote today, as far as I can tell, on the Amash Conyers anti-surveillance amendment, which has now passed through committee. I mentioned yesterday that General Alexander, the head of the NSA, requested and had a four-hour meeting with House leadership behind closed doors in an attempt to, well, I mean, this is what's fascinating about it. When it became clear that this bill was going to make it to the floor and is now garnering significant support,
Dad, really quick, I just put up a link on the blog to a site where you can get your congressperson's number and call them to support this bill right now. Apparently,
okay.
A lot of people calling in.
Okay. So, yes. And so we've got this Amash Amendment. It is calling to curtail the power of the NSA from doing the mass surveillance of our phone calls. Keith Alexander scheduled a last-minute members-only briefing in response to this bill, and Marcy Wheeler breaks it down quite well. Apparently, the White House is a little bit freaked out about this amendment. It issued a statement last night saying that it opposes the amendment and urges the House to reject it. Quote, in light of the recent unauthorized disclosures, the president has said that he welcomes a debate about how best to simultaneously safeguard both our national security and the privacy of our citizens. We oppose the current effort in the House to hastily dismantle one of our intelligence community's counterterrorism tools. And this is a laugh riot. This blunt approach is not the product of an informed, open, or deliberative process. We're going to break down Wyden's speech, where he talks about how the reason why there hasn't been any informed or deliberative or open process is because the administration And our government has been creating secret law and has disallowed any informed, open, or deliberative process coming out of this session. James Clapper and Keith Alexander put out a statement saying our mission wasn't to convince the House to do anything other than to provide information for them to make a decision. Alexander told CNN, asked if they satisfied lawmakers and persuaded them not to change the program. Alexander would say it was only useful to get the facts on the table. And Marcy Wheeler makes the point, why has it taken an amendment to quash their authority to get the facts on the table? Perhaps maybe that's why there hasn't been an open and deliberative and contemplative process, is because these people have lied to their representatives in public forums over and over and over again. So the vote is going to take place today from my understanding. Apparently the Congressional Progressive Caucus is whipping its members to vote yes on this amendment. I imagine there is at least some significant support on the Republican side. Steny Hoyer is against it. We don't know where Pelosi is on this. Like I say, the vote will take place later in the day. Demand Progress has been marshaling support for this amendment. We have a link on the site at majority.fm to call your House representative, and we shall see. But this is all part of a larger process that is taking place now directly and 100% a function of the leaks from Edward Snowden. Without a doubt. And Ron Wyden was at the Center for American Progress yesterday. If you haven't had the opportunity to watch the hour-long speech, we're going to go over some of the highlights right now. Very important stuff. Here is when Wyden starts and talks about the frustration that he had. Now, Glenn Greenwald makes a point in the interview that we'll be running tomorrow that they were aware of it. They could have spoken out against it. Now, of course, they would have been in violation of Senate rules. But here is where Wyden was talking about the frustration of watching public officials lie about this secret law and feeling that he could not in any way publicize this. This is clip number one.
I had seen government activities conducted under the umbrella of the Patriot Act that I knew would astonish most of our people. At the time, Senate rules about classified information barred me about giving out any specifics. And so we came to describe what was going on as essentially secret law. A secret interpretation of the Patriot Act issued by a secret court that authorizes secret surveillance programs. Programs that I and several colleagues thought went far beyond the intent of the statute. Now, if that's not enough to give pause, then consider that not only were the existence of and the legal justification for these programs kept completely secret from the American people, senior officials from across the government were making statements to the public about domestic surveillance that were clearly misleading statements. And sometimes they were simply false. Senator Mark Udall and I tried again and again to get the executive branch to be straight with the public, but under the classification rules observed by the Senate, we aren't allowed to exactly tap out the truth in Morse code.
Again, the statement from the White House, this blunt approach is not the product of an informed, open, or deliberative process. Wyden goes on to say, note there was no public discussion of this and there was no means in which to review how the law has been interpreted. This is number two.
At a time of understandable panic, the Congress gave the government new surveillance authorities. But the Congress also attached an expiration date to these authorities so that they could be deliberated more carefully once the emergency, once the immediate emergency had passed. Yet in the decade since, the law has been extended several times with no public discussion about how the law has actually been interpreted. The result, the creation of an always expanding, omnipresent surveillance state that now chips away needlessly at the liberties and freedoms our founding fathers established for all of us, and it's all done without the benefit of actually making us safer. So today, here at the center, I'm going to deliver another warning. If we do not seize this unique moment in our constitutional history to reform our surveillance laws and practices, we are all going to live to regret it.
And then Wyden goes on to talk about how this secret law works and how radically expansive it is growing in this without any transparency.
Months and years went into trying to find ways to raise public awareness about secret surveillance authorities and to do it within the confines of the classification rules. I and several colleagues made it our mission, our special cause, to end the use of secret law. Now, when the people in my home state hear those words, secret law, several of them come up and say, "Ron, what are you talking about? How can the law be kept secret? When you guys pass laws back there, it's like a public deal. I'm going to look this stuff up online." And in response, I tell Oregonians that there are effectively two Patriot Acts. There's one that you can read on your laptop if you're sitting in Medford or Portland, and you can analyze that and understand it. Then there's the real Patriot Act, the secret interpretation of the law that the government actually relies on. The secret rulings of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court have interpreted the Patriot Act, as well as Section 702 of the FISA statute, in some surprising ways, and those rulings are kept secret from the public. And I can tell you, those rulings can be astoundingly broad.
Then Wyden goes and explains, and this is something that I have been saying over and over again, but he does it very clearly and succinctly. It's very important to understand how the FISA court evolved from the way it was set up in 1978 as a result of all the work that the Church Commission did in investigating the excesses of our spying agencies, how it evolved from that point to where it is today in terms of how the FISA court actually functions. So clip number four.
When the FISA court was created as part of the 1978 FISA law, its work was pretty routine. It was assigned to review government applications for wiretaps and decide whether the government was able to show probable cause. For all you lawyers, it sounds like a garden variety function of district courts and district court judges across the country. In fact, their role was so much like a district court that the judges who make up the FISA court are actually current federal district court judges. After 9/11, the Congress, of course, passed the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendments Act, and this gave the government broad new surveillance powers. These new powers didn't resemble anything in either the criminal law enforcement world or actually the original FISA law. The FISA court got the job of interpreting these new, unparalleled authorities of the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendments Act. It was their decision to issue binding secret rulings that interpreted the law and the Constitution in the startling way that has come to light in the last 6 weeks. They were to issue the decision that the Patriot Act could be used for dragnet bulk surveillance of law-abiding Americans. Outside of the names of the FISA court judges, virtually everything else is secret about the court. Their rulings are secret, which certainly makes challenging them in an appeals process almost impossible. Their proceedings are secret, but I can tell you they're almost always one-sided. The government lawyers walk in, they lay out the argument for why the government ought to be allowed to do something, and the court decides basically on the judge's assessment of the court's, of the government's arguments. That's not unusual if a court is considering a routine warrant request, but it's very unusual if a court is conducting a major legal or constitutional analysis. I know of no other court in America that strays so far from the adversarial process that has been part of America for centuries.
And that aspect that he's outlining there, the body of secret law, the functioning of a secret court, the way that it is in no way conforming to the way that we know courts function in this country, to me is one of the most problematic aspects of all of this, because it fundamentally short circuits the democratic process, and we cannot make an informed decision as to how far we want our government to go in curtailing our rights to supposedly give us security. For those people who say Congress has no right to complain about this now, they have known about all of this, Sarah Wyden had this to say, clip number 5.
Now, defenders of this deception have said that members of Congress have the ability to get the full story of what the government is doing on a classified basis, so they shouldn't complain when officials make misleading statements, even in a congressional hearing. This is an absurd argument. Sure, members of Congress could get the full story in a classified setting, but that doesn't excuse the practice of half-truths and misleading statements being made on the public record. When did it become all right in America for government officials' public statements and private statements to differ so fundamentally? The answer is it's not all right, and it's indicative of a much larger culture of misinformation that goes beyond the congressional hearing room and into the public conversation writ large.
And another way of saying that is that they're lying. And here he explains the process he undertook to force James Clapper to tell the truth about the NSA's surveillance capacities, the steps he took to basically give Clapper the opportunity to tell the truth, and how Clapper refused to take those opportunities. Here's number 6.
A few months ago, I made the judgment that I would not be responsibly carrying out my oversight powers if I didn't press intelligence officials to clarify what the NSA director said repeatedly about data collection. So I decided it was necessary to put the question to the Director of National Intelligence. So I had my staff send the actual question over a day in advance so that the director would be prepared to answer. The director, unfortunately, said the answer was no. The NSA does not knowingly collect data on millions of Americans, which is obviously not correct. After the hearing, I had my staff call the director's office on a secure line and urged them to correct the record. But disappointingly, his office decided to let this inaccurate statement stand. My office made it clear, my staff said clearly that this was wrong and that it was unacceptable to leave the American people misled, and I continued to warn the public about the problem of secret surveillance law over the following weeks in effect until the June disclosures.
And those June disclosures he's talking about, of course, came from Edward Snowden via the Washington Post and the Guardian. Now, then Senator Wyden goes on to talk about the argument that these programs, and we're, you know, in this instance, he's talking about essentially the two major programs that have been revealed. One is PRISM. This deals with hoovering up all of our online information. The other is the mass surveillance, the hoovering up of the metadata and the content of phone calls and simply banking them. He says that PRISM has had some of been somewhat effective. He still calls for more privacy protections regarding PRISM. But he points out that the NSA has been combining, when they refer to these two programs together, as a way of hiding the fact that the phone surveillance, as far as he has seen and as far as he is aware of, has provided nothing of intelligence value. Here's that, number seven.
Now, even after those disclosures, there's been an effort by officials to exaggerate the effectiveness of the bulk phone records collection program. One way they do that is to conflate it with the collection of internet communications under Section 702 of the FISA statute. This collection, which involves the PRISM computer program, has produced some information of real value. I will note that last summer I was able to get the executive branch to declassify the fact that the FISA court had actually ruled that on at least one occasion that this collection violated the Fourth Amendment in a way that affected an undisclosed number of Americans. And the court also said that the government had violated the spirit of the law as well. So I certainly think Section 702 needs stronger protections for the privacy of law-abiding Americans, and I think those protections could be added without losing the value of the statute and the collection. Meanwhile, I haven't seen any indication that the bulk phone records program yielded any unique intelligence that was not also available to the government through less intrusive means. When government officials refer to these programs collectively, and we have seen that on a number of occasions, and say that, quote, these programs provide unique intelligence without pointing out that one program is doing all the work and the other one is basically along for the ride, in my judgment, that is also a misleading statement. And there have been a number of misleading and inaccurate statements made about Section 702, the PRISM program and its collection as well. Last month, Senator Udall and I wrote to the NSA director to point out that the NSA's official fact sheet contained some misleading information and a significant inaccuracy that made protections for the privacy of our people sound much stronger than they actually are. The next day, the fact sheet was taken down from the front page of the NSA website. Would the misleading fact sheet still be up there if Senator Udall and I hadn't pushed to take it down?
Undoubtedly. It would have been still up there. And then the other question is would they have taken that action were it not for the revelations that we have seen from these unauthorized leaks from Edward Snowden? Senator Wyden goes on to talk about some victories they have had in creating more transparency and in shooting down some of the administration's attempts to punish whistleblowers. And he speaks of a growing concern in the Senate and the House as to these issues, which I think is we are seeing actually play out today with this Amish Conyers amendment. Also, and maybe not coincidentally, Thomas Keene and Lee Hamilton, those who sat on the top of the 9/11 commission, wrote a op-ed today. I believe it was in the in Politico.
Yes.
They wrote, in part, the NSA's metadata program was put into place with virtually no public debate, a worrisome precedent made worse by erecting unnecessary barriers to public understanding via denials and misleading statements from senior administration officials. When the Congress and the courts work in secret, when massive amounts of data are collected from Americans and enterprises, when government's power of intrusion into the lives of ordinary citizens, augmented by the awesome power of advanced technologies, is hugely expanded without public debate or discussion over 7 years, then our sense of constitutional process and accountability is deeply offended. Officials insist that the right balance has been struck between security and privacy, but how would we know when all the decisions have been made in secret with almost no oversight? We'll be running that interview with Glenn Greenwald tomorrow, where we talk about what he perceives to be, at this point, the biggest revelations from the leaks that came from Edward Snowden. Also, I ask him a little meta questions about Edward Snowden and the process in which he went through to vet Edward Snowden. Fascinating stuff. You can tune in tomorrow for that. Now we're going to head into the better half of the program, the number 646-257-3920. You can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. It is your support that keeps this program alive. It will make it easier for us to provide you with even better content. It'll make it easier for us to continue the program going forward. It would be much easier, I have to say, to spend 30 minutes analyzing the marriage between Wiener and his wife and Huma and all the possible conjecture that could go into that that seems to fill hours upon hours of cable television. It would be significantly easier.
It was like pulling teeth to get Sam to cover that Wyden speech. He had this grid of different theories of Huma and Wiener.
Right.
Brought into
and I had to put
today.
That down. No, but I, you know, folks, honestly, there is, it is the more capacity we have to provide you stories that involve more thought, the more we will do. And that just involves having more members. So if you can afford to become a member, please become a member today at majority.fm. You can support the show in other ways by buying your junk that you buy through Amazon through our Amazon link at majority.fm. Just click on the link at the bottom of the page, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon junk through that. It won't cost you anything. You won't know any difference. We'll get a kickback. Justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. We'll see you in the better half. 646-257-3920. The IM is Majority FM.